Inevitably be something Carby seasoned with pig.
Thanks, hon. You're a lifesaver.
Walking out the employee door, Margot swigged the last of her water and prayed she could make it to the van before the sweat rolled down her back. Across the lot, she spied Aunt Donna. She was standing on the dock, arguing with a tall African-American man while waving what looked like a large hook in his face. Margot thought about intervening, but Duffy was standing right there, and when he saw Margot, he waved cheerfully, like there wasn't a battle royale going down on their dock. If Duffy wasn't alarmed, she wasn't going to risk life and limb to help. The more frightening question was why Duffy wasn't alarmed. Was this normal behavior from Donna? As the van cooled, Margot took advantage of the stronger cell signal and checked her phone. There were three increasingly urgent voice messages from Carrington, her former boss, asking her to call back right away. An inadvisable thrill of hope blossomed in Margot's middle. Could this be the end of her exile? Was it possible that Carrington and the partners realized they couldn't run the company without her and were asking her to come back? Or maybe Carrington was just trying to give her a tip on a good job in another city. That would be just as welcome. Margot plugged her earbuds into her phone jack and hit the callback button so quickly she almost dropped the phone on the van's floor. Margot rolled the van out of the parking lot. Carrington picked up on the first ring.
Margot, sweetie, how are you? Did you really move to Georgia? Or is Cecily in HR drinking again? Is it dirty and awful there? Tell me everything.
I did move to Georgia, Margot said, a bit stiffly. It's not dirty or awful. It's actually very nice here. It's warm, but I'm living in my family's lakefront property. I'm very comfortable. It wasn't a lie, exactly.
That means I owe Cecily $10. I told her there was no way you'd move that far away from civilization. But she said you left a forwarding address for somewhere called Lake Sackett. I guess she wasn't exaggerating.
Margot rolled her eyes. Had Carrington phoned to gloat over her situation, or was there a point to this call? She thought they were friends before she left Chicago. And just for her ego's sake, she'd hoped that someone from her old life would call. It was possible she was still feeling residual anger at her father. But she found that she was annoyed with Carrington and her condescending tone. "Is there something I can help you with, Carrington?" she asked. "I'm on my way to meet some friends."
"Really? Well, I needed to ask you about the florist you used for the Hopman Enterprises executive dinner last year. Franz simply refuses to follow the color schemes I'm giving him. He always seemed so cooperative when he worked with you. What's your secret?"
Margot huffed. "You fired me. That means you lose my secrets. I'm not super inclined to help you, especially since you've probably given Mandy my job by now."
"Of course we didn't promote Mandy to your job. We promoted Natasha."
"Natasha? The intern?" Margot exclaimed.
"It's nothing personal, darling. Natasha's put in her time. It's only fair to give her a chance. Besides, I was only calling to see how you were doing down there in the sticks. I know it has to be awfully hard, but think of it like those boot camps where they send teenagers into the woods for character development. You're going to come out of this stronger and better for it."
"I'm going to go now, Carrington. If you change your mind and decide to be a team player, you can..." "Goodbye, Carrington." Once she managed to shake off Carrington's concern, Margot found the elementary school pretty easily. It was at the end of Main Street, located right next to the Lake Sackett Middle and High School. Dozens of families were milling around the parking lot, while a screen-printed "Welcome to Back to School Night" banner flapped over the main entrance. Margot could only hope that Mary Ann's parent-teacher conferences had gone well. She didn't want to be stuck in the car while her cousin dressed her children down for whatever kids got into trouble for in the middle of nowhere. Her own parent-teacher conferences always seemed to end with some sort of lecture at home about how she could be trying harder,
doing more to bring her A's to A-pluses. She parked the funeral home's van in the lot and noticed the uncomfortable looks she got from the parents, like her presence at the school was somehow wrong. She wondered if Marianne's older son had reached the age where he would be embarrassed by being picked up in a funeral home vehicle. She walked through the front entrance, narrowly avoiding collision with the kids darting around the construction paper-bedecked lobby. If she'd known that her suit would be in danger of contact with gummy, glitter-covered hands, she would have worn the emergency poncho stashed in the back of the van. That mothering instinct that made women decide that sleepless nights and perpetual yoga pants were a fair trade for tiny, cute people? She did not have it. She valued quiet. She valued her time. She didn't judge the people who had kids. She understood the necessity of children. She did. Someone had to run the retirement community where she would inevitably end up. She just had no desire for her own. The sight of a boy running down the hall with his shirt pulled over his head, his belly painted with a neon green smiley face, confirmed that she'd made the right choice. Marianne dashed past Margot, without looking at her, yelling, "Nate!" So that was what Frankie meant by it being better to meet Marianne without her boys around as a distraction. Marianne had clearly birthed Hellspawn. "I'll just wait here, Marianne," Margot called down the hall. She pursed her lips. She didn't hear me. Margot scanned the lobby, looking for a place to sit among the homemade posters and display dioramas of dinosaurs. But the school seemed to have some sort of policy against sitting. No benches, no chairs, nothing. She glanced toward the office. Maybe they had a waiting room or something. A place where she could protect her clothes from the thin layer of sticky substances that seemed to coat every surface in this building. Her eyes landed on a familiar face, and she gasped. It was the haunted lumberjack, he of the comfortable truck seat and agile tongue. He'd cleaned up considerably, wearing khakis and a crisp white button-down shirt. His hair was neatly combed. He was smiling, talking with other parents, but the smile didn't quite reach his eyes. He barely had a grip on it. That grip slipped entirely when he saw her. His eyes went wide, and his mouth dropped. She wasn't sure whether it would be more awkward if he didn't recognize her. Her face flushed hot. Why was he here? He was supposed to be off, smoldering in the forest somewhere, staring pensively into the distance. Oh, no. Was he a parent? Had she climbed into a truck with a married man? She couldn't see his ring finger, as his left hand was curved around the shoulder of a nearby woman. Was Margot going to have her ass handed to her by some backwoods bottle blonde for him violating their marriage vows? No, wait. He was wearing a name tag. Maybe he worked here. Which would be better. Right? And he was making eye contact. So much eye contact. Because the whole "I know the exact texture and circumference of your tongue" element of this interaction wasn't uncomfortable enough. He wiped his hands on his khakis as he crossed the lobby, again preventing her from seeing his ring finger. And he didn't reach out to shake her hand as he asked, "Hi. Are you a new parent here?" "A parent? Me? Oh, no, 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 no." His brown eyes went wide at her tone, and she stammered, I mean, it's not that I don't like children. I like them just fine. When they belong to other people." His lips pinched together, but a snicker escaped. And then his lips parted into a dazzling smile, hesitantly, as if he hadn't done it in a while. Margot shook her head and returned the smile, hoping it was half as stunning as his. "Never mind. What are you doing here?" She glanced down at his engraved metal name tag, which read, "Kyle Archer, Principal." "You're the principal? At an elementary school?" Kyle frowned.
Yes?
Why does that seem to upset you?
Oh, I'm not upset. I just didn't expect it, she said.
You don't seem like the educator type.
She couldn't help but notice, now that she wasn't completely addled by moonshine, the lack of an accent. Unlike the molten sugar twang of most of Lake Sackett's residents, Kyle's speech had the quick, sharper tones of the Northeast. And there was the smile again. Slow to bloom, but sweetly sincere.
What type do I seem like?
Lumberjack? Underemployed poet? Spokesman for paper towels? Margot managed to keep those answers to herself and changed the subject.
Aren't you kind of young to be a principal?
There were very few candidates when I applied. It was between me and the guy who wanted to remove prepositions from all of the grammar textbooks.
Well, then I'm glad they hired you.
Me too.
He lowered his voice and stepped so close she could smell that clean, crisp fabric softener smell. She could feel sweat gathering behind her knees. That was a new reaction to a man.
So, you've made it very clear you're not a parent. Why are you here?
Margot scoffed. This man was not good for her. Despite seeming somewhat reluctant about his flirting with her, he made her feel things that were reckless and do things that were just plain stupid. Kyle Archer and his soulful beard were dangerous. And yet, she leaned closer too. Then she leaned a little closer, because if he happened to get a glance down her blouse, that was just the blessing of good tailoring.
Family? I'm picking up my cousin and her sons.
Really? Who are they? Maybe I could at least figure out your last name, which you haven't bothered to share with me. Or your first name, actually. It was pretty sexy at first, but it's getting weird.
Margot Carey, she told him, glancing to his name tag.
Nice to meet you, Mr. Archer.
Kyle raised a sandy eyebrow.
Oh, I think we're on a first-name basis by now. But I don't have any students named Carey.
Oh, well, it's not my local family's name.
Margot!
They turned to find Mary Ann, showing considerable upper body strength for a petite woman, tucking her struggling 7-year-old child under her arm like a football.
You okay, hon? You're a little... What's a name for a color between pink and red?
Blush, Kyle said, the smirk still in place. So you're related to Nate and Aiden?
Margot is my cousin, through Stan,
Marianne supplied.
Sweetie, are you sure you're okay? Maybe the heat is getting to you.
I'm fine. Everything is fine. Absolutely and totally normal, she said, looping her arm through Mary Ann's. An older boy, possibly 9? Margot was not a good judge of these things. With Mary Ann's big blue eyes and dark hair, followed them out the door, his nose stuck in a Goosebumps book.
Okay, we'll pretend I buy that, Mary Ann said. Mr. Archer, thank you for your time earlier. Carl and I appreciate your patience with Nate.
Hey, we want progress, not perfect, right, Nate?
Kyle held his fist out for a bump, which Nate stopped squirming long enough to return.
Yep.
Bye, Aiden. Try not to run into anything, Kyle said, snickering, as even an admonishment from his principal didn't raise Aiden's head from his book.
He leveled Margot with those bitter chocolate eyes.
It was interesting to see you again, Margot.
I'm sure we'll run into each other again very soon, Kyle, she said, her lips twitching into a smile. Kyle's brow creased, but he nodded slowly.
Looking forward to it.
Margot followed Mary Ann's hustling form out the school door.
That was weird. Mr. Archer never talks to the moms in that tone of voice,
Aiden said, still not looking up from his book.
What tone of voice? Like the way my dad talks to my mom when it's almost bedtime,
Margot's jaw dropped open.
Come on, Aiden. Keep up, hon, Marianne said, bouncing Nate on her hip. Margot, Frankie texted and said you didn't have lunch. Let's go get the boy something to eat while we wait for Carl to fix the car. Nate gets a little out of sorts when his blood sugar gets low.
Really? Margot asked. She looked to Aiden, who shrugged. What's that like? Aiden sighed.
You don't want to know.
Chapter 6 The Rise and Shine was a cozy, traditional diner with worn red vinyl booths and a shiny black and white tile floor. Hank Williams Sr. blasted through the jukebox in the corner. The race car-themed pinball machines looked like they might have been original to the building construction in the 1960s. And when Marianne and Margot herded the boys through the door, Margot couldn't help but notice that people stopped talking. A lot of people. They weren't even subtle about staring at her. Margot was being weighed and measured, and based on some of the sneers she saw on the other customers' faces, she was not making a great impression, which was weird considering she hadn't spoken or even moved yet.
Sorry, Marianne murmured. You were a little less visible at the Dirty Deer. Let's just get a table, Margot whispered, as Nate tugged her toward a booth in the back.
Tell me honestly, is it the way I dress? Is that why people stare?
Nah, people around here don't take much notice of tourist types, but, your mama didn't leave a great impression when she took off. I don't want to speak ill of the dead, but my mama says that Linda never let someone's feelings get in the way of her sharing an opinion. And she had a lot of opinions. She gets a lot of bless her hearts.
That I believe, Margot muttered. The diner served breakfast food, and only breakfast food, all day long. Because as the mustachioed owner, Ike Grandy, said right on the front of the menu, this is America, and I'll serve any damn food I want. There was a whole panel of the menu devoted to grits. But Margot was determined to order the rabbit food special, a fruit plate and a veggie egg white omelet, to try to counteract some of the fried food she'd eaten over the last few days. She was also determined to avoid sweet tea, asking for a Coke instead. Their waitress, Marla, smiled warmly, her teeth showing stark and bright against the smooth teak-colored skin, and asked,
"What kind of Coke would you like? We got regular, diet, Sprite, root beer, and Fanta."
"Just a Diet Coke, please," Margot said. Marla nodded and made for the kitchen. Margot turned to Marianne. "You know, I've been ordering half-calf non-fat lattes from Starbucks for years and never had the complications I've had here."
"You're in Georgia, sweetie, home of Coca-Cola. Folks call all sodas Coke, no matter what brand they are. And then it's up to you to get specific."
Marianne leveled Margot with her blue eyes and asked,
"So, what was that with Kyle Archer earlier?"
"Nothing," Margot lied smoothly, as her cousin lifted an imperious dark brow.
"Principal Archer is nice most of the time, unless you take things off his desk and build towers with them,"
Nate told her, as he constructed a tower from tiny square butter containers.
"And then he makes you write 'I'm sorry' sentences."
"Have you done this more than once?" Margot asked. Nate's bright blue eyes darted toward his mother, as if he was mentally reviewing his Fifth Amendment rights.
"He's okay," Aiden said, his little face serious as he set his book aside. "He doesn't take any bull crap."
He paused to sneak a look at his mother, who frowned.
"Any trouble from anybody? But he's fair about it. And when he says he's going to do something, he does it, which is more than I can say for some of the grown-ups at the school."
"Aiden, honey, why don't you and Nate go play some pinball?"
Marianne said, giving them each an equal stack of quarters.
"No rocking the machine!"
The boys promised solemnly as they swept their change off the table and ran to the bank of video games across the diner.
Okay, seriously, what's going on? Marianne asked.
Margot shrugged and restacked the sweetener packets in the table caddy.
I may have met up with your kid's principal at the Dirty Deer last night and made out with him a little, she said quietly, well aware that people at the surrounding tables could be listening.
There was some grinding and groping involved in the front seat of his truck.
That's where you disappeared to last night, she cried. I didn't even see you or hear about it. Do you know how hard that is to pull off in this town?
Well, clearly I didn't pull it off because now you know about me and my throbbing id.
Still, you had 24 hours, Marianne told her. That's an accomplishment. You should be proud. Around here, everybody sees everything. And just in case you forget something stupid that you did, there will always be someone who's known you since birth to remind you.
Margot's face went hot. As much as she wanted the information, she couldn't bring herself to ask about Kyle's background. Not just because she was embarrassed, but because she didn't want to give the impression that she was attaching herself to someone local. She didn't know if she would ever feel the kind of instant connection with anyone, certainly not in the way Marianne and Carl shared. And she didn't want to give Marianne the wrong impression about her commitment to Lake Sackett.
That sounds claustrophobic. It can be.
So, throbbing id, huh? Margot nodded.
Do you think that you and Kyle might be a thing?
I don't think so. I didn't even know his name was Kyle until I saw his name tag at the school. That's probably not a foundation for a lasting relationship.
Well, just so you know, he's a really nice guy. And not one of those nice guys you read about on the internet, but a truly sweet person. Really good with the kids at school, very understanding of Nate and his special brand of creative chaos.
Just one thing. Ike, the owner, interrupted, delivering the food himself, carefully spinning the plates heaped with waffles and bacon and eggs into their correct spots without being told who had ordered what. As the boys gave warrior whoops and stampeded back to the table, Ike leveled Margot with a long, speculative stare.
I want you to know I am serving this plate under protest, he said,
as the rabbit food special came to a stop in front of her.
No one ever orders the rabbit. It's there for profiling purposes, but you're Stan's girl, so I'm gonna let it slide. Just this once.
Margot managed to refrain from the "you have disappointed me" stare she normally gave mouthy servers. She did not appreciate the reminder of her absentee father at the moment.
Next time, you're getting the smokehouse breakfast with a side of hash browns, and you're gonna eat the whole thing,
Ike told her sternly.
I won't be responsible for you blowing away in a stiff wind.
I appreciate your concern. Ike nodded and grumbled.
Boys, remember, no throwing the jellies. Marianne, my mama would like to pass along to Miss Tootie that she's bringing 7-layer salad to the card game this week.
I'll let her know,
Margot promised, as the boys dug into their pecan waffles. Adult conversation was impossible while Marianne tried to get her children through a meal without a maple syrup explosion. Nate needed help cutting his waffles. Aiden had trouble opening up the ketchup bottle for his hash browns and then elbowed his water over onto the table while handing it to Margot. As soon as Marianne got them settled and raised a fork to her lips, Nate had to go to the restroom. And due to an incident involving the hand dryer, he wasn't allowed to go alone.
Is it always like this?
Margot asked Aiden as Marianne led his brother to the bathrooms. Does your mom ever get a hot meal?
Nah, sometimes we spill more,
Aiden mumbled around a mouthful of waffle. Margot shuddered. The door to the diner opened with a peal of bells. Margot glanced up, and her fork stopped midway to her mouth. A scruffy-looking man with dishwater-brown hair hanging over his eyes stalked through the door. While handsome in a lean, unrefined sort of way, he also had the hardened look of someone who never quite had a break in life. He wore a Dawson Towing t-shirt with the sleeves ripped off and jeans streaked with grease. The muscles of his arms were sharply defined in a way that spoke of capability, not gym hours. He glanced around the diner, scanning, frowning. Margot put her arm around Aiden in a protective sweep. Oh, no. Margot had not spent nearly 30 years successfully avoiding victimhood in Chicago to be killed in a diner robbery in Georgia. She slipped her hand into her purse and dialed 9 and 1 before Marianne and Nate emerged from the restrooms. The scruffy man spotted Marianne, and the natural scowl seemed to slide right off his face. Margot had never seen someone light up before, but this man's sharp features softened to anime levels of adorableness. His eyes brightened to an emerald green. His smile was wide and dazzling.
"Hey, baby,"
he exclaimed. Margot frowned and glanced around. Was he calling for one of the other customers? Marianne turned and melted at the sight of the man while Margot was trying to remember wanted posters from her last trip to the post office. She pointed to their table.
"Hey, sweetie, we're over here."
Margot lifted a brow. "Sweetie?" Marianne giggled like a tiny, tiny schoolgirl as the man wrapped an arm around her waist and kissed her soundly.
"Got your van all fixed up with a new battery. Jeter dropped me off so I could drive you home."
"Oh, thanks, baby. Cousin Margot, this is my husband, Carl Dawson. Carl, this is my cousin Margot."
The boys started talking a mile a minute and leaped up to climb all over him, which he greeted with hugs and unabashed kisses to both. And then he turned that devastating smile on Margot. And suddenly she understood why her cousin had given up a comfortable life in Atlanta to come home to her high school sweetheart. To have someone look at her the way Carl was looking at Marianne, like she'd personally hung the moon and stars and then threw the sun up in the air just for bragging rights, Margot could see how Marianne would sacrifice quite a bit. She didn't know if she could ever do the same, but she saw the benefits.
"Well, it's nice to meet you, Margot. My Marianne has told me all about you,"
Carl rasped, in a bourbon-soaked drawl that should not have been sexy.
"Nice to meet you, too," Margot said.
"Sorry, I thought you were going to rob us because I'm a classist, judgmental cliché," was silent. Ike delivered a plate of ham, bacon, sausage, scrambled eggs, and biscuits to the table.
"Hey there, Carl. I brought your usual." "I appreciate it, Ike," Carl said, shaking Ike's hand.
Ike leveled a stern look at Margot while he pointed to Carl's gravy-laden plate.
"The smokehouse breakfast. This is a proper meal."
"Noted," Margot said. Ike nodded and backed away from the table. Aiden took a seat at the end of the table to make room at the foretop. The boys began chattering about their school day and who had thrown what at lunch. Carl listened patiently, nodding and asking enough questions to show that he was paying attention. Margot just watched the volley of conversation bounce around the table, with her heart clenching inside her chest. She was glad her cousin was happy. She was glad the boys had a doting father. But it only served to remind her of what she didn't have. Margot wondered if this was how Marianne's family dinners usually went, or if the excitement of back-to-school night and dinner out was making them especially lively. She couldn't remember a single meal in her home being so loud or relaxed. Mother had insisted on playing classical music while the three of them ate at the dining table. Conversation was always polite, but distant and cool, barely heard over the Chopin. And her mother had never craned over the table to give her full attention to Margot's stories from school. Margot frowned, wondering again how different life would have been if she'd grown up in Lake Sackett. She couldn't picture Mother and Stan having animated, cheerful meals together, but at least watching a happy family eating wouldn't feel like something out of National Geographic.
"So how was the school meeting?" Carl asked.
Marianne groaned and dropped her head nearly to her plate. Margot's eyes cut toward their youngest. I can leave if you don't want me around for this. I mean, parent-teacher conferences are sort of like medical records in terms of none of my business.
Oh, no,
Marianne assured her.
Both the parent-teacher conferences went really well. Aiden's already 10 points ahead of his accelerated reader goals. Nate's math proficiency is shot up to the 92nd percentile, and his trips to the office are down by 20%.
Carl offered both boys silent fist bumps.
The meeting Carl's talking about is the parent committee for the Founders Festival, Marianne said, looking to her husband. And it was exactly what I expected it to be.
Carl grimaced and tucked into his bacon.
I'm assuming the festival is a really big deal around here?
Margot asked. Marianne sighed.
Yes, it's coming up in early October. We've been planning for months, but nothing has actually been accomplished because every time the committee makes a decision and presents it to the PTA president, Sarah Lee Bolton, she rejects it and does whatever she wants, while Mr. Archer tries to keep up. Meanwhile, the rest of us have already made plans and reservations and payments based on what we thought were the plans, and everything gets undone and confused, and I have to count to 100 so I don't end up shouting profanities in a children's school.
Margot shuddered. So why is the Founders Festival so important?
Well, after the water dump, we have less to draw tourists to the town, Carl said. For Founders Day, we do up a farmer's market and a craft fair and games and rides. People come down and make a real family trip out of it. And with fewer people coming into town for fishing and boating and the like, we have to draw even more people in to make up for the loss. We've stretched it out to more of a Founders Week.
And why is Mr. Archer involved? Margot asked, ignoring the smirk Marianne tried and failed to hide behind her hash browns.
The elementary school kids do a play and a concert and presentations about the town's history. Plus, the rides are all set up on the school grounds. And the retired principal always made a big point of being part of the planning, Marianne said.
Carl's green eyes narrowed at Margot, and she felt herself swallowing in a noisy gulp.
You know, you probably wouldn't be half as crazy as Sarah Lee when it comes to all this planning stuff.
Margot bit her plump bottom lip.
Was that a compliment?
I'm just saying that if we have this all-powerful fancy-pants event planner, who better to plan it than her?
Carl said, nodding to his wife's cousin.
You could do some good for the town, and build a little goodwill for MacReady's as you go.
Marianne stood up and lunged across the table to grab Carl's work shirt, pulling him into a fierce kiss. Margot imagined it tasted like gravy.
You are freaking brilliant sometimes. You know that?
Though his cheeks flushed pink, Carl jerked his shoulders and casually returned to his food.
Of course I am.
What do you say, Margot?
What? A hostile takeover of planning for an event that I'm completely unfamiliar with that's only about 2 months away? In a place where I have no connections or vendor pull? That's insanity. Why don't you do it? Margot asked. You're the one with children at the school.
My name is Mud when it comes to working with the community and anything involving children or charity or the public. It's a long story, Marianne said, turning to her youngest. Nate,
Puppy face. Nate wiped his mouth with the back of his hand and very carefully poked out his bottom lip, angled his chin down, and widened his eyes to the point that Margot feared for his eyelids.
Please, Cousin Margot, won't you please help run the Founders Festival and save our town?
Margot pursed her lips. That's playing dirty, she told Marianne.
I'm a desperate woman.
I don't even know if I'm going to be here in October, Margot exclaimed. I could get a job offer in the next few weeks and move. And then where would you be? Even more confused and unproductive. Marianne frowned, as if she'd forgotten that Margot wasn't a permanent resident of Lake Sackett.
Oh, right. Sure.
I'm sure it will work out just fine, Margot said. This always happens with big community events. Egos and chaos and details that don't get addressed until the last minute. But it will come together. Trust me.
Sure.
Marianne looked down at her plate and poked a bit of egg around with her fork.
So, Aiden, tell me about this new book you're reading. No scary ventriloquist dummies this time, right? That one gave you nightmares for a month.
Nope. This time it's garden gnomes thirsting for revenge, Aiden said, grinning viciously.
Carl gave an exaggerated shiver and ruffled Aiden's hair.
That's creepier than the dummies. I don't trust anything that tries that hard to be cute.
Margot glanced at Nate, who was still using the puppy face while reaching for the strawberries on her fruit plate.
Exactly.
Margot was relieved and disappointed that Stan wasn't waiting for her with an explanation when she arrived at work the next morning. She buried herself in details and busy work. She faxed. She filed. She even vacuumed flower petals out of the West Chapel when Eunice Woodson's grandson knocked over a vase full of daisies. And that nauseating mix of anxiety and irritation hadn't ebbed out of her stomach. It was still there, hovering under her diaphragm, when Uncle Bob poked his head in the door, his expression uncertain.
Margot, are you done with the Branson file?
Yes, she said, handing him the manila folder from the neat stack on her desk. While Bob had handled the planning and sale portion of the process, the Branson service was the first set of paperwork that Margot had completed on her own. It had not been easy, given all the customs and niceties, not to mention state laws, she'd had to remember while talking to Mrs. Branson. And it had given her an odd sense of accomplishment to finally slide the file into the outbox. Mrs. Branson called to double-check some details. And I talked her into upgrading to the Buchanan casket with the bronze fittings, rather than just the brass-plated, Margot said proudly. And the bronze-lined burial vault, plus the waterproofing, which I don't think anyone has ever ordered here given the way the supplier reacted when I requested it. Mrs. Branson agreed with me that it was a much more fitting tribute to her husband. And if it happened to add another $4,000 to her total bill, so be it. She offered her uncle a cheeky smile, which he did not return. In fact, Uncle Bob looked downright horrified.
Margot, what were you thinking?
I was thinking that if Mrs. Branson wanted to make herself feel better by spending a little extra on her husband's funeral, and the business happens to make a little extra money, what's the harm? I took Mr. Branson from a Toyota Tercel funeral to a nice, respectable Cadillac. Bob's voice dropped to a stern level she'd never heard out of her cheerful uncle.
The harm is that Arlene Branson can't afford to spend a little extra on her husband's funeral. Her George's cancer treatments ate up most of their retirement funds. She's having to move in with her daughter as it is. To play on her grief like that, to make her spend more, that's not how we do things, Margot.
Margot's brow wrinkled. upselling was one of her main skill sets at Elite Elegance. She was known for her ability to talk clients into premium catering orders, bigger floral arrangements, better linens. It was what she did. The idea that this talent might not be appreciated at MacReady's left her unsteady. She wasn't sure what else she had to offer. "I'm sorry. I didn't know we were running a non-profit," she said crisply.
"That's not what I meant, and you know it. We're not running a charity. But we are running a company that has stayed in business for almost 100 years because we don't treat our neighbors like sheep for the fleecing. We're part of the community, Margot, and we take that seriously."
"Fine," Margot said. "I'll keep that in mind." Bob's lips pinched into an unhappy expression.
"I'm going to call Mrs. Branson back and explain to her that the suppliers didn't have those upgraded features after all. But we can give her a deal on a package somewhere in the middle. Give Mr. Branson a comfortable Ford Taurus funeral."
Margot knew he was trying to soften the blow with a joke, but she couldn't find it in her to smile. She prided herself on her work ethic and talent. Flamingos aside, she'd never been chastised for how she handled events. And at this stage, she didn't need the knock to her confidence.
"I'll leave you to do that."
Margot stood and grabbed her purse. "I'm going to go into town and grab some lunch. Would you like something?"
"No, Leslie's got me covered. Why don't you let her fix you something at the snack shack?"
"Because I need to eat something green that doesn't involve gummy candy," Margot shot back. "I'll be back in an hour."
"All right, then."
Bob sounded disappointed in more ways than one as he sat at her desk and picked up the phone. Margot sped down the hall and outside into the stifling heat. This was manageable. A little fruit, some lean protein, and she would be back on track. Everybody has bad mornings at work, and it wasn't as if Tootie was going to let Bob fire her. Of course, she'd had a bit of a spat with Tootie the last time she'd spoken to her, too. Maybe there was a reason she'd grown up without an extended family. She didn't seem to be very good at it. Margot rooted around in her purse for the set of truck keys Duffy had graciously shared with her. And when she looked up, she realized she was walking toward Stan, who was waiting for her by the truck. He looked more rumpled than the first time she'd met him, more worn. The bags under his eyes were even more pronounced now that those eyes were infinitely sadder. But his eyes were clear, and his hands were steady. "Just what I need," she muttered under her breath. Stan chewed on his lip as she approached, as if he was still trying to figure out what to say to his daughter. Margot made it very easy for him. "Whatever excuse you have for standing me up yesterday, I don't want to hear it," she said, clipping past him. She still couldn't find the damn keys. How did giant, pre-keyless entry metal monstrosities like that get lost in her relatively small purse?
"Margot, I'm sorry," Stan said.
"Sorry for what exactly?" she asked, her voice icy as she pawed through makeup, tissues, her phone. "Missing a lunch you agreed to? The first commitment you'd made to me in 30 years? Or being absent for those 30 years? Because if it's the former, don't worry, I'm used to it."
"I don't know what your mother told you about me."
"She told me you were a drunk, that you weren't the sort of man she wanted raising her daughter, that you were unreliable and unstable. She wasn't wrong. She's still not." Her fingers closed around the keys, and she pulled them free.
"About the drinking? No, not at the time. She was right about that,"
he agreed.
"But I'm dried out now. Got my 20-year chip, even though I never got to make my amends to you. Your mama was right."
"I don't want to hear it," she said,
unlocking the door and yanking it open. I really don't. I was wrong to reach out to you. I was setting myself up for disappointment. I don't want your excuses. I don't want a dramatic apology. I don't want to hear about your feelings. I just want to come to work, earn my keep, and get out of this town, and far from you.
Margo, please. I didn't mean to hurt you. I never did.
Margo wedged her foot into the truck and hurtled into the driver's seat. And yet you have, over and over. You had a choice yesterday. You chose not to show up.
I wanted to, but...
She slammed the door. But, unfortunately, Duffy had left the window down. So this conversation continued. Was there a work-related emergency that couldn't have been handled by anyone else? He shook his head, swallowing thickly.
No.
A mechanical failure affecting every vehicle in town that prevented you from keeping your appointment with me? Stan's big, sad eyes narrowed a bit, like he didn't appreciate her frigid tone of voice.
No.
A cell phone tower outage that kept you from being able to call me to tell me you weren't coming?
No.
So, you chose not to show up. You let me sit here, in my office, waiting for you, wondering where you were. And you didn't think that maybe that would hurt me? Margo slid the keys into the ignition.
No, I knew it would. But I thought it would be better than hurting you some other way.
That's bullshit. It's emotionally lazy bullshit, she snapped. Look, when someone shows me who they are, I believe them. You've shown me every day since before I can remember who you are. I believe it. Now please, just let me work. Nothing's changed. We don't know each other and we don't have to know each other. We are two strangers who happen to work in the same office, and that's fine. I'm fine. Stan stiffened, staring at her for a long time.
If that's what you want.
It is. Margo nodded, turning the key. The engine roared to life, and Stan's response was drowned out. Margo gunned the engine, whipping her head forward and speeding off. Chapter 7 Margo couldn't bring herself to go to the diner and face people, so she went home to forage in her fridge. As the truck bumped over the gravel drive of the MacCready compound, she spotted Arlo waiting for her on her front porch. His ears perked forward, and he hopped to his feet as she climbed out of the truck.
Oh, no, she said. You just go home to Aunt Tootie. I don't have time to lint roll away dog hair. I only have an hour for lunch.
Arlo whimpered and cocked his head to the side. Seriously, go, Margo said, shooing him away with her hands. Now! Arlo darted to the door and plunked his butt in the center of the frame. I will wait you out, she said, leaning down and pointing a finger in his face. I outlasted a shoe model who threatened not to walk in the Ladies' Charity League spring fashion show until she got a hyper-dry, triple-shot soy cappuccino, because there's no such thing. I can outlast a rescue mutt.
Arlo yipped and licked at her finger. Sighing, Margo turned her back on the dog and stared out at the sunlight flickering across the expanse of the lake.
She hated to admit it. But her view was one of the things she enjoyed about living in Lake Sackett. In the mornings, she got up a few minutes early just to drink her coffee while watching the dragonflies dart across the surface. After dinner, she'd spent the evening on her porch, just staring out at still water purpled by twilight. Margo glanced down the drive. She still didn't know who had once lived in the yellow house with the dilapidated green roof. She hadn't had time to ask anyone. She thought she would feel crowded and put upon living so close to the family. But Margo found it was a lot like living in her apartment building. She knew her family was close by, but everyone seemed to respect each other's privacy. And there were times she was absolutely unnerved by the silence. She was used to the constant rumble of traffic and the wail of sirens.
even in her relatively nice neighborhood. The lack of noise made her feel like her cabin was surrounded by a layer of styrofoam. But now, the noise in her head felt overwhelming, like she had an ocean between her ears, roaring and crashing. She couldn't believe a simple lunch invitation had turned out so badly. It was a nightmare. All of her childhood insecurities, every question she'd asked herself about her father, all dredged up at once. She sank to the porch step, not caring when the seat of her pantsuit landed on the dusty wood. Her mother had been right. Her father wasn't a father. He wasn't capable of that kind of responsibility, even sober. Linda was not a mother who hugged or even showed approval that often. But she'd done a loving thing in taking Margot away from here. Arlo padded over to Margot and slipped his head under her arm and into her chest. She sighed, forgetting about dog hair, and combed her fingers against his neck. The warmth of his fur and his heartbeat under her hand, even with the doggy smell, were comforting. She relaxed around him, letting her face drop against the top of his head. For a brief moment, she let her eyes burn and water. She took a wobbly breath. Why did missing one stupid lunch hurt so much? She'd had worse done to her by people she liked more. Why was she giving so much power to someone she barely knew? And why was she burying her face against dog fur? "No," she said, gently easing Arlo out of her lap. "No offense, Arlo, but no." She stood, shoving her door open. Arlo yipped and dashed into the house. "No, Arlo!" Arlo hopped on the couch, made a couple of circles, and burrowed into a throw pillow. "You're not staying." Arlo made a whining noise that sounded like a canine version of, "That's what you think." Margot crossed to the fridge, which had nothing green in it. Nothing. Not even mold. She groaned. "That's it. I'm taking the rest of the day off." Margot drove Duffy's truck to the food carnival at the end of town. While Leslie and Tootie had been diligent about delivering casseroles to her door, Margot really needed to start stocking her own pantry. She couldn't keep living on a diet entirely based on Velveeta and cream of chicken soup. As she pulled into the parking lot, she reminded herself that she'd shopped in tiny bodegas while living in the city, and she could make do with whatever she found on the shelves. And then she walked into the cheerfully lit shop, saw motor oil displayed right next to fresh fruit, and almost lost her nerve. While there were huge pallets of sunblock, beer, and pool noodles, there were no ethnic foods beyond the pasta aisle. There was no organic produce. And when she asked for the health food section, the clerk directed her to a display of Flintstones vitamins. She was a little discouraged by these developments, but they weren't nearly as concerning as the store's use of Snacky the Clown as its mascot. She stocked up on produce, almonds, and oatmeal, and with apprehension turned toward the toiletries section. She brought half-full bottles of her prestige brand toiletries to Lake Sackett, expecting them to hold out until she found a new job and moved on. But she was running low on basically everything, as the ridiculous heat had her showering twice a day. Between her dwindling funds and spotty internet access, she was going to have to break down and buy bargain brands. She fully expected her pampered blonde locks to rebel and detach themselves on principle. Margot was considering which over-scented fruity body wash would offend her sensibilities the least, when a girl around age 5 with a honey blonde ponytail ran full tilt into her legs. The girl bounced off Margot and went sprawling across the floor and started crying. Margot glanced around, searching for a parent who would fix this. But most of the other shoppers were just staring at her as if she'd knocked a child to the floor on purpose. "I don't know what to do here," Margot said, helping the girl to her feet. The little girl leaned her head back, opened her mouth, and let loose sobs that could have shattered the store's front windows. Margot couldn't help but notice the girl's wind-blown hair and a very interesting outfit, consisting of khaki shorts, a purple and orange striped sweater, and pink rain boots with little green whales on them. Maybe she was one of those feral children you saw on the news? It would explain the fashion choices and the lack of a parent to soothe her out of her sobs. Margot awkwardly patted the little girl's arms.
I don't know how to deal with crying kids. Do I give you a band-aid? A hug? What's going to make you feel better?
Suddenly, the girl stopped crying, and her huge brown eyes popped open.
Candy!
Margot's own eyes narrowed, but there was a little quirk to her lips as she said,
Oh, you're good.
The little girl grinned and did not look one bit sorry. There was something familiar about that expression.
June?
Daddy?
The girl's head snapped left as Kyle Archer rounded the corner of the body wash display. He sagged with relief when he saw Margot crouched in front of his daughter. Margot quickly released June's shoulders and stood, taking a step back from the girl. Damn it. This was just not her day for uncomfortable interactions with fathers. Fathers. The little girl had called her truck seat paramour Daddy. Margot's stomach dropped.
Where was the mother?
She glanced down at Kyle's ring finger, which was bare, but still showed the faintest of tan lines. Not married, then. That was a relief. Margot took a step back, staring at Kyle's open smile. How could he look so happy with his daughter in his arms, but so miserable when he was away from her? Was it a custody thing? Was he only cheerful when his daughter was around? Kyle lifted the girl into his arms and leveled her with serious, but not angry, eyes.
Juniper Grace Archer, we've talked about this. You can't run off on your own at the store.
Sorry, Daddy. I was bored, June said,
as if that explained abandoning her father in the grocery store and giving him a minor cardiac incident. Kyle turned his attention to Margot and lifted a dark blonde eyebrow. Margot raised her hands in surrender.
I swear I am not stalking you.
He smirked.
That's what the last girl who stalked me said.
I didn't knock her down or anything. She ran around the corner and bounced off of me.
June? We've talked about that, too,
Kyle scolded. Juniper shrugged.
It gets me around faster.
Margot tried to back away slowly from the little domestic scene, but Kyle turned to her.
I'm sorry. I'm usually better at supervising my own kids, but my other daughter was picking out a shampoo, which is sort of a Wisdom of Solomon thing, and June got away from me.
Oh, she said, nodding and trying to back away down the aisle. All right, then. See you around.
Actually, I could use your help, he said, with the shampoo thing. You're a woman.
Thank you for noticing, she deadpanned.
And you're probably better at picking out this stuff than I am, he said,
his cheeks flushing under his beard.
Why is it so hard to pick a shampoo?
She asked. Kyle cleared his throat.
Well, an older girl, maybe 7 or 8, stepped around the end display and into the aisle, looking highly disgruntled.
Her hair was several shades darker than her sister's. It was also several times larger than her sister's, forming a sort of unintentional cloud of frizz around her head. Margot flinched.
Oh.
Hazel tried a new shampoo this week because it smelled like One Direction is supposed to smell. Don't ask me why that makes sense. It's a girl thing and I can't possibly understand. And it made her hair all flat and stringy looking. So I got her a volumizing shampoo, which was obviously a mistake because she has naturally curly hair, and the chemicals awoke something evil in it. We tried defrizzing shampoo and dry shampoo, and it